The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Russell. I'm the editor of the New Statesman now. Not on a permanent basis. He is Jason. He's the normal editor. They were having some problems with him, so I've been asked to step in. Look at this issue. Shepherd Fairey done that. He's a brilliant artist. We're talking about revolution. We've got contributions from Diablo Cody, that's won an Oscar. That's good. She's writing about aliens. Naomi Klein, she's a journalist or psych. And she's writing about climate change and the necessity for a revolution in our thinking around climate change. We've also got Noel Gallagher. He's done his best to use human language, but it's more like some sort of shrieks and squeals that come from any simian creature a little bit lower down on the evolutionary scale. Gary Lineker, a football revolution. David DeGraw, he's a proper revolutionary. He's talking about economics and all that kind of stuff. Noam Chomsky's involved. Amanda Palmer, look, I've got a list here just to let you know that's what goes on behind, yeah? In fact, what's really required is a revolution in consciousness, a revolution in the way we see information, a revolution in truth, and that's what we're talking about. Rupert Everett, Alec Baldwin, David Lynch, Paul Mason, I don't actually know him, that's exposing my ignorance there, I bet he's bloody good. Graham Hancock, he's out there, that guy, he's saying that we should access new realms of consciousness through psychedelics, then bring that information back to our society and evolve together. Dave Shrigley, he's well funny. Pinchbeck, he's like a sort of a contemporary shaman. And me, I'm going to be going out on a limb to say stuff that causes trouble. I'm going to be talking about our leaders that we have now, what I reckon of them, Boris Johnson, David Cameron, George Osborne, Maggie Thatcher, your boys are going to take one hell of a beating by the New Statesman. I'm Russell Brand, this is a thing, what I have done. Jason, you can have your job back. You stab me
one by one. Well, Jason might have his magazine back, but I've got the podcast back. My name's Helen Lewis. I'm the deputy editor of the New Statesman. Today, I'm going to be talking about Labour, energy and the SNP with Raphael Baer and George Eaton. And our new blogger, Ian Stebbins, is going to tell me about how to 3D print an armchair out of fungus. Yes, you heard that right. I'm joined by Raphael Baer, our political editor, and George Eaton, editor of The Staggers, to talk about the week in politics. Let's start, George, with John Major. Rehabilitated at last, the Cohn's hotline forgotten. So tell us about what he did this week.
He turned up at the press gallery lunch in Westminster on Wednesday and started, unusually for Major, firing off stories. And so the most interesting intervention, which actually came not in his speech, but in response to a question from the floor, was on energy, where he called for this windfall tax on the profits of the big six. My reaction was initially to wonder, was this a bit of Tory kite flying? Was he sort of road testing this on the Tories' behalf? Soon became clear that wasn't the case, and Downing Street described it as interesting, which is, you know, a euphemism for very unhelpful, as we saw at Prime Minister's Questions yesterday, where Ed Miliband's quite brilliantly actually picked up Cameron's line that anyone who wants to intervene in energy is living in a Marxist universe. It says, has the Red Peril now infected John Major? And what was really odd was that Cameron didn't seem to have a witty riposte to that. He had almost 24 hours to prepare for that. And just seemed, I've never seen him looking so helpless. I mean, by the end, he looked like a beaten boxer, sort of desperately waiting for the bell. He even stood up before Miliband had finished speaking, and Miliband sort of signalled him to sit down again. I mean, with the exception of the Syria vote, I've never seen him look more weak or more helpless.
Yeah, it was the most comprehensive defeat of David Cameron by Ed Miliband in a Commons performance I've
was
seen.
Was it an Ed Miliband win or a David Cameron loss, though, if that makes
it
sense?
It was an Ed Miliband win because he took control of it, and you get that sense with the exchanges that every time David Cameron stood up to try and come back, he couldn't sort of wrest control of the exchange. That obviously means it was an unusually weak performance by Cameron, but nonetheless, when there's an open goal, it's not unheard of for Ed Miliband to sort of spoon the ball over the bar, and so to actually plant the ball very resolutely in the back of the net, even when the goal is open, that still counts as a Miliband win.
But you wrote, Raph, earlier this week that you think it's unlikely that the Tories will come out immediately with a kind of instant riposte to this.
Well, interestingly, I mean, they sort of had an instant riposte to the extent that Cameron said, oh, okay, well, we'll scrap all green taxes, because there is there are renewable subsidies that make their way onto your fuel bill, which arguably, you can get bogged down in the detail, but make them a little bit more expensive than they might otherwise be. I don't think they'll get any traction from that. There are two reasons why the Tories said that. First of all, because they think it's all entirely political. There's no economics in it. They think if you get the conversation onto green taxes, then you can start talking about Ed Miliband's legacy when he was Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, and somehow you can say, actually, it's your legacy, it's your fault.
Put these green taxes
on
the start.
Yes and no. I mean, some of them, this has been a long-standing policy to try and effect the transition from energy sources that are completely unsustainable and very expensive to ones that in the long term might be more sustainable or renewable. So that's it. But you can easily make the argument, Ed Miliband, as a sort of economically illiterate hippie back under the last government, who not unentitled to be prime minister,
he does look like a hippie.
Well, not in a suit, they hope, down in Ed Miliband's office. But anyway, that's a separate issue. You can try and pin this stuff on him. So that's one reason. And the other reason is that both ideologically and politically, they feel very strongly at the top of the Conservative Party that the way to respond to this whole cost of living assault is not to say, we can rummage around in our little goodie bag of wheezes and gimmicks and give you a present, voters. It is to grow the economy and then cut taxes, because then you get more money in people's pockets. And they believe that on principle, and they believe that's better.
This
politics.
Is this weird metaphor of growing the pie, isn't it? Which is, someone needs to talk to them about, actually, they should watch the Great British Bake Off, because if you grow the pie, then your slice of the pie is automatically larger. Which brings us very neatly onto nuclear power. Great segue.
The nuclear pie.
The nuclear pie is also growing. Exploding, hopefully.
Hopefully not actually. No.
We wrote in the Leader this week that the new nuclear power, we think, is a good idea. We think renewables aren't really ever going to bridge the energy needs. But, George, we have some reservations about the way that this is, the Hinkley power plant is being funded.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, here's the government that has said it's an act of socialist madness to freeze energy prices for 2 years. They've now guaranteed the French state-owned EDF and Chinese state companies energy prices for 35 years at twice the current market rate. There are a lot of people who actually think that prices will rise by much less than that, or even fall, if there's this huge, big abundance of shale gas, and which has brought prices down in the US. And what that means is that it's then the British taxpayer who will pick up the bill for that in the form of the subsidy, while their Chinese and French counterparts will benefit.
Which I think is very peculiar. You think, well, hang on a minute, the French and the Chinese must see some reason that this is a massive upfront investment is going to be pay off them in the long run. What do they know that we don't?
Well, no, what they're prepared to do is subsidise upfront, transparently, at the taxpayer's expense, because they recognise there are reasons why you might want nuclear as one of your energy sources, but they also recognise that commercially, left to the market, no one is going to build a nuclear power station without state guarantees. And this is why this has been a sort of, you could see, particularly this is a problem for the Lib Dem policy, because they went from saying we hate nuclear, you know, can't we just eat yogurt and wear sandals instead, to saying, well, okay, if you must do nuclear, well, we're not going to spend any public money on it. And that was a particularly ridiculous position, because everyone, every expert in the field will tell you, you need a subsidy to guarantee this in the long term, even if there are benefits in terms of security of supply and long-term cost coming down and the rest of it. So they've sort of got themselves into this situation where they have done something, you know, if they want energy in the nuclear in the mix, they have done the thing that everyone says they have to do, but they've had to do it in this way that sort of makes them, it has a kind of deceptions and subterfuge sort of built into the process. So they're not, can't really get any credit for it. They just accepted that, you know, they were in, as it comes back to this point about the sort of ideological squeamishness about saying this is an intervention or a subsidy. It's both, obviously, but they've had to structure it in a way that might not actually be great for Britain, or as good for Britain as it might have been if, yeah, in 2010, they'd been honest about what they thought was required.
And just to talk about Scotland for a minute, Nicola Sturgeon, the SNP, said they would have, what is it, 5% cut to energy bills if they get independence, which is this odd idea that actually they're kind of running an election campaign. They're offering kind of giveaways and freebies. Doesn't that make it very hard for the Better Together campaign, who haven't got anything to offer? They can only offer, well, you'll get whatever everyone else gets in the general election.
That's right, but I think Labour have slightly drawn some of the sting from the SNP attack, because Miliband has actually started talking about what he'll do in 2015. One of the things Alex Salmond hoped after he won a majority and planned to go ahead with the referendum is that he would be able to warn Scottish voters, if we don't get independence, then we are going to be under the Tory yoke, for a second term majority Conservative government. That's looking much less likely now. And Ed Miliband has come out and said, "I will scrap the bedroom tax. I will freeze energy prices." And now the SNP campaign on the bedroom tax slightly deflated by that. But you know, I think the SNP definitely feel as if there is still mileage in the idea that Labour still is unwilling to mount a full resistance to Tory austerity. And
the New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber, who offer their drivers worker protections and a range of benefits, including access to fully funded undergraduate degree courses through the Open University.
It's like a dream that was something that was missing from myself.
Sanan Ahmed has been driving with Uber for 8 years.
I start driving with Uber because it provides flexibility. You can work whenever you want. I couldn't complete my studies before. I had a huge gap of almost 5 years. I'm going to get into IT. I was working full-time with Uber, and they gave the opportunity, like, you can study while you work. With the Open University, it was the same thing. It's flexible. You can take your lectures whenever you're free. I've studied the bachelor's in business management, graduated last year. Currently, I'm doing my master's. That impact that Uber and Open University had on my future, I'm very positive. Now I've got goals that I've set for myself, and before there was no way I could achieve it. But now I feel like I'm in the right direction.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
You know, the Scotland is a distinct country from England in terms of its attitudes to welfare and to the economy, and the SNP represent that. But I think the polls will narrow, but I can't see. It would require even for a politician as talented and as astute as Alex Salmond, sort of an incredible comeback.
Well, on that note, I'll leave it. Thank you very much, George and Raph.
Thank you.
Some of you may remember a late, great, departed blogger called Alex Hearn, who used to talk to me quite a lot about science. Well, we've got a new Alex Hearn, a better Alex Hearn. Don't tell him I said that. Welcome to Ian Steadman, who's just joined us as our science and tech blogger.
Hello. Thank you. I'm slightly taller. I can't say
you are one and a half
I
Alex Hearns.
I can't say whether I'm better yet, but I'm taller. definitely.
Well, I'll commission a poll or something. Or Alex can solicit some comments now that he's at The Guardian.
Yes.
As part of their open journalism programme.
Exactly.
I'm going to talk to you a little bit about, I think, maybe the best headline we've had on the site this week, which is, would you sit in an armchair grown from a giant fungus?
I would. Would you?
I was much more reassured when I found out that talk us through the what happens. It's in plastic, isn't it? The fungus.
It is in plastic, so you don't actually have to touch it. Don't worry about that. But this is 3D printing, which I don't know. Have you done it on the podcast before?
I'm not sure we've ever talked about 3D printing, but basically the idea that you can create a three-dimensional model of something and then create it out of either paper or metal, so you can put metal powder and then run an electron beam or a laser through it.
Yes.
Or
plastics.
Cheap, crappy-looking plastic.
Yeah,
stuff,
well,
which is
you
a
can
lot
get some really good
happen.
Plastics these days, but it's more expensive. But the price is kind of dropping. And the thing that's really exciting about it is that you can sort of scan in anything and recreate it. You can download models for stuff off the internet and things like that. You can really kind of, in the same way you could pirate music, sort of 10, 15 years ago, you can start thinking about pirating objects, which is quite a strange thing to think about. But that's where it seems to be heading.
I like when you say that, like, that's definitely a good thing and might not be finally the thing that kills off the newspaper industry.
I don't think it's going to kill the furniture industry necessarily, because you're still going to want to have furniture. You're not going to have, you know, there's always going to be a market for people building tables and chairs, but there's also going to start being like, you know, I've broken something on my phone, like I want a new screen on my phone. I could go to the Apple store and pay a lot of money to have it replaced because it's out of warranty, or I could just print a new one using the right kind of material to make the glass. That's the kind of thing it is. It's can upset quite a lot of manufacturing standards and mechanisms as we understand them now.
So what happens with the chair? How do you print with fungus?
Some people have been experimenting with growing things into shapes as a kind of other material for 3D printing. This is a Dutch designer called Eric Klarenbeek, who calls himself an artist of the unusual, which is quite accurate, I think. And what he's done is, instead of printing with plastic or metal, he's printed a sort of mix of straw, water, so kind of like a pulp, with what's mycelium, which is like the roots of mushrooms and fungus.
Mm.
If you've ever gone digging through a wood, you'll
isn't
see
that. Isn't that just corn?
I think it is kind of related to
kind of sofa hacked from corn.
Pretty much.
I should mention that Ian's a vegetarian, but
I
employed him anyway.
Yes. Thank you for not holding that against me.
Yeah. So
the mycelium grows.
My question is how tough is it? How hard is it?
Apparently, it's very durable. It's comparable to something like wood. It grows through the sort of pulpy mass where the water is and fills in the gaps between the straw and kind of creates this solid, strawy, mushroomy kind of material. It's very light, very strong. You can sit in it. There's a picture on the website of it. He's built a full size chair that looks kind of like.
It looks a bit Game of Thrones.
It looks very Game of Thrones. I mean, you could do any shape, but he did it that shape specifically because he said he wanted to show off it was like this kind of organic way of printing things.
Could we grow ourselves the throne, the Iron Throne?
Yes, you could.
Except out of giant fungus.
With this, you could do any shape.
Throne.
Yeah, yeah. Although you do have to sort of watch out for mushrooms kind of growing off it, because once they've filled out the whole shape that you've printed, they start sprouting.
Yeah.
So he wraps it in a kind of thin, biodegradable plasticky stuff. Sort of. So as far as it feels like, it feels like a plastic chair, but the material it's made out of is a fungus.
Which presumably is quite ethical. It's quite biodegradable if the plastic's very thin compared to the amount of fungus.
Absolutely, yeah. The plastic itself is meant to be biodegradable as well as the fungus. I'd say you could throw it away, but if you threw it away, it would just start growing again, I guess. So,
it's unkillable,
yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, you could grow yourself a new chair from your old chair if you really wanted to, probably.
And then it's a big debate in science at the moment. So you have. But, you know, there's a huge amount of excitement about 3D printing. The Science Museum's got a 3D printing exhibition on at the moment. Where do you stand on the from enthusiast to skeptic line?
I think it's going to I think it's going to be world-changing. I don't think it's going to be the most world-changing thing that is coming. There are some other things that are KPMG did a very interesting report a few months ago looking at sort of technologies that are coming in the next 10, 15 years. How much they're reported in the media and how realistically they're going to impact on this, like the economic impact. And 3D printing is one of those things that it catches the imagination because it creates these fantastic objects. So it's written about a lot, but the...
And you can use it for pretty much everything, right? So yeah. I was interviewing a guy who's grown a bladder, which is great, because at the moment, if you lose your bladder, they have to implant you a new one made of intestine.
Yeah.
Which, otherwise, intestine is designed to absorb, bladders are designed, frankly, to not absorb. So it's much better to kind of essentially grow a replacement.
Yeah, imagine you could print off, instead of getting an off-the-shelf fake leg or fake arm that doesn't really fit you properly, you can get one that's modelled on your real limb that you lost, for instance, stuff like that.
And there's a guy who's crowdfunded for about $6,000, I think he's hoping to sell them from the end, a decent working prosthetic hand.
Yeah.
It's not the highest tech thing in the world, but I mean, his belief is that you could take it to the developing world where you can't afford $150,000.
And that kind of shows off exactly what the most important thing about it is, which is the culture around 3D printing. It's not just the fact that you can create these things, it's that you create, it's, you know, they talk about maker culture, the idea that you create your own accessories and stuff instead of having to rely on some company somewhere injection molding something in China to their design and you finding which one of them you like. You can just build it yourself.
That's what I really like about it, because it reminds me a bit of, I feel we, you know, our generation, I lump you together with me on this one, but we missed out on that. How exciting must have been when you had those early computers. I've been reading the Stephen Johnson book, Levy book, about hackers, and about that kind of the excitement. They would go down and they would tinker with it. And that's, I kind of remember a bit of that. We had, you know, computers in our school that I did BBC Basic and you could learn to program. And then that's gone, and now you get your lovely Apple iPhone that is given to you by Apple and you just take it, you know, just accept it. It's a closed product.
Actually, I was listening to a radio show the other day, I can't remember what it was, but they were talking about why there are so many good hackers in Russia, and it's because the Soviet computers were so terrible that they had to learn how to hack well to overcome their limitations.
And write really tight code, because you know, the thing was kind of on the
blink.
They
had like 12K of memory or something stupid like that, where so they really have to overcome it. And but 3D printing is gonna change the world a lot in terms of bringing what is now quite a lot of centralized manufacturing, making decentralizing it again, sort of creating a culture of making, I think.
But by law, I believe when we talk about 3D printing, we're obliged to mention the Liberator.
Yes, the handgun.
So the Defense there we go. A Texas-based company made these plans available. They were downloaded 100,000 times before the Department of Defense pulled them off the internet.
And it's a working hand. I think the only thing it needs is a nail to create the spark. So you just hammer a nail into a certain part of it. But everything, including the spring and everything, is 3D printed. And it works.
Well, there's a one in the Science Museum. Unfortunately, it's in bits because it exploded. And I know that Willard Foxton, who we've had on the podcast before, he writes about tech for The Telegraph, has offered that if someone can home print an assault weapon by the end of the year, he will go and let himself be shot with it, because he's convinced that it was more likely to do damage to the person who's firing it. Like,
I'd agree with him on the first go, but I mean, it depends if he allows them to like have several goes, because that, like, the first time they did the Liberator, it blew up. There's all these videos of them trying going out into the New Mexico desert or wherever and just shooting into rocks and things and it just exploding.
Do they pull the trigger with one of those things we used to open the windows with in school?
I think they just wear big gloves.
Wow.
Like, they're brave. I mean, they're brave, sort of, they see themselves as almost frontiersmen kind of thing. You know, they've got that really American individualistic spirit of sort of, I have this weapon that I created myself and I'm going to defend it. You know, it's all
when
about
the coming apocalypse comes and the government can't defend you, then it'll just be you and your 3D printer.
I don't think they're going to overthrow the US government with 3D printed guns, though. A plastic gun, as it just sounds stupid because it is. It's too weak. You might get a few shots off with it, but...
I think the Liberator's a single shot, isn't it? I mean, I think it warps the barrel, the heat of it.
I mean, you can't even get the tolerances very well on it as well. You need to be able to spin the... It's not a great gun, but it is a gun.
But it is a gun. Yeah. And on that note, I'll say thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, produced and edited by the New Statesman team. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the _ Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.